This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedure Subteam Track 2 Legal Regulatory Issue Call held on the 2nd of February, 2017. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room only. Other than Heather, if you're only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Hearing no further names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Michael Fleming. Please begin.
Good morning, everyone, and apologies that I almost overslept, but by the end here in Tokyo, and I hope wherever you are today, you are in a good environment to be listening. Let's go ahead and get started. I've already given the welcome, of course, but as our first order of business, as any other meeting, does anyone have an updated SOI? No employer, no interest, new hobby? None. Recently been wanting to get back into fishing, but I'm not going to put that in the SOI just yet. let's go ahead and move on. This week we're going to be continuing our conversation on registrant protections. Last week we introduced the topic, and I feel that we went fairly quickly. Apologies personally for that. There's a lot to cover in this working track. We have a lot of topics and so few meetings to jump into that, of course. At the current time, we need to go over a lot of that, but still, we need to be keeping a lot of this conversation on email, and I've lodged a few emails hoping to keep the conversation, but for asking questions in regards to these racial predictions, but replies to that have been few, unfortunately. So, at the same time, let's continue the conversation this time around. We're going to be talking about the background screening mainly, and then I hope to begin the CC, well, no, not I hope, we will begin the CC2 discussion as to what questions we should be sending out there. And lastly, of course, we have any other business. Does anyone have any other business they would like to make clear and deserve some time to speak about it? Hearing none, let's continue. Terry, I don't see that I have controls of these slides. Can I ask that we go to the next slide?
Certainly. And actually, Michael, I'll bump you up to host so you can to presenter, and you can turn the slides yourself going forward.
Ooh. Shoot, upgraded. That sounds wonderful. All right. So here's the agenda as we just went over. So, background screening. As many of you are aware, as part of the applicant evaluation process, I can conduct the background screening based on information that was provided in questions 1 through 11. The background screening mainly regarded two specific areas, general business diligence and criminal history, as well as history of cyber squatting behavior. The criteria used for criminal history were aligned with the criminal crimes of trust standards sometimes used in the banking and finance industry. Specifically speaking, these questions were the applicant information, which included the full legal name, the address of the principal place of business, the phone number, the fax number, and if applicable, the website of the URL of the applicant. And then question 6 looked at the primary contacts information, such as the name, title, address, phone number, fax number, and email address. And then question 7, my apologies, this is a little bit harder to see, looked at the name, title, address, phone number, fax number, and email address of the secondary contact. The next questions actually gave the necessary information, well, gave the more conclusive information that was used in the background screening. This was the proof of legal establishment that looked at the legal form of the applicant, the specific national or jurisdiction where the entity was established, and the evidence of the applicant's establishment. Question 9 looked at whether or not if the company was publicly traded to provide the exchange and symbol. If the entity was a subsidiary needed to provide the parent company, or if the entity was a joint venture, you needed to list the venture partners. And then, probably my favorite question was the applicant background information. This looked at the names and positions of all directors, names and positions of all officers and partners, names and positions of all shareholders holding at least 15% of shares. Now, for an applicant that did not have any directors, officers, partners, or shareholders, it was necessary to provide the position of all individuals having legal or executive responsibility. Once that information was provided, ICANN would conduct background screenings, and according with several areas, and while I would rather not read all of these, you can see here that we have A through M follow on the next 3 slides, but of course for the introduction of this material, I feel it necessary to do so as well. So please bear with me for the next 5 minutes. So when a background screening was included, ICANN would check for the following areas. Within the past 10 years, has anyone been convicted of any crime related to financial or corporate governance activities, or had a judge, or has been judged by a court to have committed fraud or breach of fiduciary duty, or has been the subject of a judicial determination that ICANN deems as the substantive equivalent of any of these. B, within the past 10 years, has been disciplined by any government or industry regulatory body for conduct involving dishonesty or misuse of the funds of others. C, within the past 10 years, has been convicted of any willful tax-related fraud or willful evasion of tax liabilities. D, within the past 10 years, has been convicted of perjury, forswearing, failing to cooperate with a law enforcement investigation, or making false statements to a law enforcement agency or representative. E, has ever been convicted of any crime involving the use of computers, telephony systems, telecommunications, or the Internet to facilitate the commission of crimes. F, has ever been convicted of any crime involving the use of a weapon, force, or the threat of force. Moving on to the next page, we continue the areas of included in the background screening. G, has ever been convicted of any violent or sexual offense victimizing children, the elderly, or individuals with disabilities. H, has been convicted of the illegal sale, manufacture, or distribution of pharmaceutical drugs, or been convicted or successfully extradited for any offense described in Article 3 of the United Nations Convention Against Illicit Traffic in Narcotic Drugs and Psychotropic Substances of 1983. I think there might be a typo there, but it's either it's 19883 or 1983. We'll just leave it at that. I has been convicted or successfully extradited for any offense described in the United Nations Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime, all protocols 4 and 5. J has been convicted with the respective time frames of aiding, abetting, facilitating, enabling, conspiring to commit, or failing to report any of the listed crimes above. Example, within the past 10 years within the past 10 years for crimes listed in A through D above, or ever for the crimes listed in E through I above. So I think it's important to note here that obviously the time frames for which any of these crimes were committed differs depending on the crime itself. K, has entered a guilty plea as part of a plea agreement or has a court case in any jurisdiction with a disposition of adjudicated guilty or adjudication withheld or regional equivalents within the respective time frames listed above for any of the listed crimes, i.e. within the past 10 years for crimes listed in A through D above, or ever for the crimes listed in E through I above. L, is the subject of a disqualification imposed by IACAN and in effect at the time the application is considered. Moving on to the next page. M, has been involved in a pattern of adverse final decisions indicating that the applicant or individual named in the application was engaged in cyber squatting, as defined in the Uniform Domain Name Resolution Policy, UDRP, the Anti-Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act, ACPA, or other equivalent legislation, or was engaged in reverse domain name hijacking under the UDRP, or bad faith or reckless disregard under the ACPA, or other equivalent legislation. Three or more such decisions, with one occurring in the last 4 years, will generally be considered to constitute a pattern. N, fails to provide IACAN with the identifying information necessary to confirm identity at the time of application or to resolve questions of identity during the background screening process. O, fails to provide a good faith report to disclose all relevant information relating to items A through M. So that introduces the subject on the background screening. Next, we'll be looking at questions, but I'm hoping that this was enough information for everyone to understand that when an applicant submits an application to IACAN, a background screening in regards to people that have control within the applying entity will be conducted in these areas, A through O. Does anyone need any more explanation in regards to this, or can we move to the questions? No? Okay. So let's move on to the questions. So, question one. I think it's first and foremost necessary to always ask the question, are the background checks a sufficient mechanism for protecting registrants? Yes, no, or other? Jeff Noon, by all means, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. This is Jeff Newman. I think, and I was hoping Paul McGrady would be here because he had a specific issue that he wanted to discuss on count, I think, M that he went over with the cyber squatting. A client of his, yes, M, thank you. M as in Mary, who's on this call. Hi, Mary. Paul had, on behalf of a client, filed some public comments on one of his client's applications. The general comment page I could put in the chat, but actually I can't because the letter doesn't exist on that link anymore. But if you look at the public comments, since it is public, the client, the customer was, or the TLD was .ping, and he had a comment that was, I think, split into six different public comments because it couldn't fit into one. And he had asked certain questions about the background screening M that, in his view, was not applied. I don't know if that went to a reconsideration request or whether there was an, I don't think there was an IRP or any formal dispute on it, but I do think that we should look over at the comments that were made to see if we think that they were, that ICANN followed its, followed the rules, or whether they're, not for that particular application, but whether we might need some clarification in this language that, would be helped by reading what happened. Yes.
I'm done.
Oh, Paul's here. Good. Oh, I was just trying to introduce some comments you filed. But he's typing.
Sorry to join late. So, Paul, we just went over the introduction of the background screening, and we looked at the areas in which ICANN conducts the background screening, the areas they look at. And Jeff was introducing a past example where you provided public comments in regards to Section M here, and he was hoping you could might be able to provide some insight in whether or not for our question one, where the background checks are a sufficient mechanism for protecting registrants.
Sure. So this is Paul. Sorry to join late, and something came up here that required some attention. So the short answer is we don't know whether or not the background checks are sufficient because ICANN didn't follow the guidebook in the case that we had where we made public comments on an application, provided evidence of dozens of UDRP adverse UDRP decisions, and were ignored. So, and then when we pressed the issue later, we're told that our application itself may be in jeopardy. I don't know that I want to go much more into detail than that because most all that's public record for anybody who wants to go look at what went down. But I will just say that, if ICANN's not going to follow its own vetting process in the applicant guidebook, no amount of applicant guidebook improvements are going to help us. So, I think that I don't necessarily know that there were any textual changes that would have helped us, except for maybe a sentence that said, ICANN really, really, really believes this section of the guidebook and promises to act under it. Otherwise, if ICANN's not going to take it seriously, then us putting in even more language isn't really going to change the outcome. So I think it has more to do with ICANN's commitment rather than text.
Thank you, Paul. Jeff also asked if you filed a reconsideration request or any other type of appeal. Would you be able to provide input in regards to that?
The short answer is, this is, again, discoverable. And by the way, I don't necessarily want to chat too much about my client and its point of view on this, but from the public record, anybody could go back through the request for reconsideration request and would note that there is not one filed.
Thank you, Paul. So I think that's a really good point, is whether or not ICANN actually follows the background screening and what's actually written in the applicant guidebook.
And by the way, in related news, this is Paul. You also, in that time frame in ICANN's history, you'll see various comments and complaints by people that the requests for reconsideration were essentially peopled by the same people making decisions. And so I know that some of that was supposed to be addressed by the Workstream 1 accountability reforms. So we just want to keep that in context, which is for request for reconsideration if we are considering that to be an important part of getting ICANN to take applicant guidebook provision seriously, then the process itself needs to be a serious process. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. Jeff, go ahead. You have the floor.
Yeah, and thanks. Thanks, Paul. I'm glad you came on to explain that so that we could put it in the record. The other thing I think we should state is, and I agree with Paul, it's really hard to say whether it's suspicion or not. What would be great is to get some data from ICANN to see, A, did anyone not, or I should say, did anyone fail the background check? I think ultimately...
You're spoiling my next set of questions. We have that lined up, so...
Oh, right. Sorry. I forgot. I knew that in advance. Sorry. Go to that question. Let's go. Sorry.
Michael, Jeff, this is Heather Frost. I'm sorry to interject, but before we move on to that next question, could I pop in?
Heather, you're more than welcome to.
Thanks. Sorry. I'm sorry I can't raise my hand since I'm on audio only. I would be very interested, before we even move on to the next question, which Jeff has identified, I'd be very interested to know if Paul's case is the only instance of this this sort of difficulty with the background questions, and not just M. This seems to me to be a super interesting data point. That Paul's example is an excellent one, but there's more force and effect behind this if we have multiple of those sorts of cases. So is there any way that we can get our hands on that data? Thank you.
This is Michael. While I personally don't have any examples of my clients that necessarily, for example, maybe failed the information or was not, ICANN did not follow the necessary check involved, I can say that the amount of information and the point of which ICANN sought information, although we said that, you know, for example, directors, there are no more directors, there are no more individuals that have control over the applying entity. The point to which ICANN pushed or asked for that information was quite a stressful process for us as well. But I wouldn't, unfortunately, I'm not aware of any specific examples where ICANN did not allow an application at this point or did not follow the process completely. Steve Chan has just provided a section of the program implementation review report that touches on the background screening for anyone that would like to see that. And as from Heather's point, I think that we need that asking ICANN for data in regards to this, obviously without it disclosing any specific names, of course, asking for as much data as possible will be necessary. And without asking that, I don't think we'll be aware of anything unless anyone comes forward, of course, and provides their own personal experience.
Michael, this is Heather.
Heather, go ahead.
I wonder if it's possible, is this something that we can go back and ask applicants on, whether, you know, formally or informally? I would hesitate to simply cover this question in the context of this discussion with however many of us are on the call. It would be very helpful to broaden the question out to a greater number of relevant parties if we can do. Thanks.
Heather, that's a good point. Judy, can we make an action item to look at this or to look at that ability? Of course, I mean we'll circulate the question over the email, but including this in CC2, which shall be our last topic of today, of course, would be a very good point, as Heather has stated, trying to get the voice from those applicants. Course, without disclosing as much, without disclosing personal information, be a good point. Terry,
Michael,
or
this
I can step on Susan was asking for the ability to scroll the slides. Go Go ahead.
Perfect. And I changed it so everyone can scroll themselves now. Thank you.
Oh, perfect. Thank you. All right. So let's go ahead and move on to the next question. Unless anyone has any requests to be looking at this specific question, you can always jump back. No? Okay. So our next question was right where Jeff was going to be asking was, question, has ICANN ever come across an applicant with an individual found to be involved in any of the activities A through M? If so, were any of those applicants disqualified from the application process because of the background screening? If so, out of how many found, how many were disqualified? So we have three areas that we're looking at here. Obviously, if anyone was ever found to be conducted within the activities A through M, and then the next set of questions looks at if any of those applicants were disqualified. That's not asked in a very good way. I'm sorry. The question really should be written. Yes, no, sorry, that is a good. So one is asking if the applicants were disqualified, and the other one is asking out of how many found, how many were disqualified. So I'm not sure if anyone's going to raise their hand on this one, but I would like to make it an action item to ask Trang or other ICANN staff to see if we can't get some form of data in regards to this area, this information. Paul McCready, please go ahead.
So Paul McCready again for the record. So I think it's just a good question to ask staff in the aggregate without revealing any IDs of applicants that got disqualified. I don't know that we're going to get any data out of disqualified applicants because I'm sure they're unhappy that they were disqualified and probably don't want to fill out another form of, a survey about it. But if we ask ICANN, how many people were disqualified in the application process and the answer is zero, that's an important thing to know. Now, I don't know whether or not that zero was I should be careful. Who knows whether zero was close to what it should have been, right? Or if zero was a travesty of justice and that essentially the vetting process was a joke. We can't tell from that number, right? But it's still a number, and so it would be good to hear from ICANN. But if it's like 15 or 20 or something like that, then maybe that indicates a more robust process that had an occasional flaw here and there, right? So I think it's certainly worth asking, at least in the aggregate. And then if we want to take a deeper dive into writing to applicants who didn't make it through the process, initial evaluation process, then maybe that might make sense to write to them and ask them what happened. But again, it's hard for me to imagine them writing in and saying, yeah, we didn't make it because, we didn't pass the background check. I don't think there would be A, any interest in doing that, or B, any interest in, confirming such a thing. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. I'm of the same opinion. Asking applicants would be a little futile in this regard, but certainly asking ICANN for that data. Like I said, I think two sets of data. One, how many were found to have anything to do with A through M, and if so, how many were disqualified? Be very, very good data. But still, Steve Chan says they're going to look at asking GDD for this. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I was going to say I believe the answer is zero. I'm double-checking because the reason I believe that is because ICANN and Trang presented stats all the way through the process of how many were in which stage and how many didn't. That stopped at some point when contracts were finally being signed. But I believe that's public, and during this call I'm searching for that. So I probably will be able to find it without having to ask ICANN for it if they have their presentations archived. But I believe it was zero that were disqualified.
So I think maybe we should change the question. Obviously, when we had the applications, we had two sets of evaluation. We had initial evaluation, and then we had extended evaluation. And there was also obviously some clarifying questions that were involved as well. Maybe we should change this question to ask how many applicants were found to have not have maybe we should ask an additional question to ask how many applicants were required to provide additional information in regards to these background checks. How many were questioned in regards to this specific area? Or I'd like to formulate this question afterwards, but does anyone have any ideas for how we could ask a better question that would provide us with some form of data in regards to the background screen? Any idea?
Michael, it's Heather Farce. Could I pop in?
You're more than welcome to, Heather.
Thanks. I wonder, so let me ask you a question. Is what you're driving at here, how seriously did ICANN take the answer no? Because I think what Paul is suggesting is, you know, if there's X number, then it may be robust, and if there is a lower number, then maybe it isn't, or something like this. And I just wonder, you know, are we reading the tea leaves here? It's a fair point, but to the extent that the answer is zero, you know, no qualifying question, or no clarifying questions, no follow-up checks, no anything, are we worried about the fact that, well, everyone answered no to all of these things, and perhaps something should have been looked into there? And if so, then whose responsibility is that, and how do we deal with it? Do we next time ask for documentation or proof, or what do we do? Or is the point that, I'm not sure where we're going with this. Are we looking to put more responsibility on ICANN? Are we looking to put more responsibility on the applicant? Are we, on the other hand, satisfied that if there were zero applications rejected and everyone answered no to all of these questions, perhaps the questions were a sufficient deterrent in the way that they were articulated? So I'm not sure what the purpose is of what we're doing right now.
Well, Heather, you have a valid point. And I think it's a little bit of, me saying it's a little bit of all those areas is obviously still unclear. But at the same time, while the questions itself in that format could have been deterred from certain applicants, you know, that might have used the process in some way applying, I think another question reason into asking that question is whether or not ICANN actually followed what was in the applicant guidebook in regards to these questions. My biggest interest is whether or not these are a sufficient mechanism. And in my next set of questions, I'll be getting into that more so, that when we start to look at different operation models of certain TLDs, whether or not these are even applicable. Because a lot of these questions were designed, you know, with the idea in mind that a TLD is going to be selling domain names or some other form of that. But when you look at the entities that actually applied this time around, and you start to ask the question of, okay, who's a director, who's an executive officer? For some of those entities, the list can be more than 100 to 1,000 people, and so looking at how deep down the rabbit hole do we need to go is a valuable point, I think. So looking at this kind of information and then maybe even jumping into that to asking, okay, depending on the type of entity that applied, from how many directors did I can actually receive information or ask information? It really, really is an important question, because my personal feelings on this is we need to be a lot more specific onto what individuals within the company were seeking that information. But while I could talk about this for a long time, I'll let Paul jump in.
Thanks, Paul McGrady, for the record. So I think that if the number is zero, then, again, other than the one instance that I know of, right, in my personal opinion, should have been a different outcome, that zero doesn't really tell us anything, right? It could have been fulsome and robust, and just everybody that applied was really terrific, right? Or it could have been a total shirking of duties. And so I think that you know, if it is zero or approaching zero, there's not much that we can deduce from that. We may be able to do something from 12 or 16 or whatever, who knows, but zero is not super helpful. I think we should be asking them, now that some time has passed, can they just, just produce the process flow that they went through. Like, so, for example, if somebody said, no, I've never been a cyber score, I've never had an adverse decision against me under the UDRP, you know, did the investigators actually check that? Was that a box that needed to be checked? Where did they check? Did they check at WIPO? Did they check at the forum? Did they check at the other places? Did they check PACER in the United States to see if there were any ACPA claims? Did they check whatever PACER is in Europe or whatever PACER is in China? Who knows, right? Those are some questions that we would, you know, in terms of seeing if the process is robust, maybe it's more important that they, without revealing any personal information about any particular applicant, show us the workflow that they did so that we can say, okay, well, if they did all these things, then that's robust enough, good for them, right? And then we can move on. Or we can say, well, you know, glad that they did all this stuff, but here are some things that, you know, we think should have been included that would have made it more robust. And we can even compare it against, you know, other ways, the questions that are asked when you get security clearance and things like that, whatever. Whatever people want to bring in from their various disciplines, that's all fine. But without having any real clarity and transparency into the process used by whomever ICANN hired to do these background investigations, I'm not sure that just a random number of how many were kept or pitched out is really going to be terribly helpful for us. So I think that's the question, which is tell us what you did once you got the answers. Did you just believe them and check a box, or did you actually do any background investigation? Thanks.
Paul, I think you make a very valuable point. And I think an additional question will be necessary. Let me take this back and formulate a question that can try to provide us with the necessary information that we're seeking. So I think one, obviously, is let's change this first question to provide us with some numerical data that might be able to provide us with some kind of insight. And then I think the second question will look at, how was the process actually followed? What forms or what areas did ICANN look at, and how was that certain check carried out? Will provide us with data in regards to if this was obviously followed. Does anyone have anything else in regards to this specific question, or how we could better formulate the question to get better data? No? Steve, please go ahead.
Thanks, Michael. This is Steve Chan from staff. And so that seems to make sense, but I think what might be the most important question to formulate is sort of the why and what we're trying to understand, which I think, you know, Paul's articulating. But I think that's a very important thing to document. And then in terms of how to answer that question, it would be, I think, good to provide examples of how to reach that, or I guess get data to understand that question. But what you might not want to do is necessarily make those data requests prescriptive, because I think the GDD, for instance, might be able to help, in understanding what data might be helpful to get some answers. So, you know, to the extent that we have an idea of what data we want, that's great, but I think they might be able to be additive to that process as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve, and we'll make a note of that when we try to formulate the questions. Jeff, you had your hand up for a brief instant, but then it sounded like Steve said what you wanted to say. So we'll just move on to the second question, to the third question. So the third question is, I'm losing my page. Okay. Do the requirements for background screening in regards to, one, general business diligence and criminal history, and two, history of cybercrime behavior prove sufficient. So again, this probably looks at the first question a little bit, but this question specifically is asking whether or not these two checks in regards to the business diligence and criminal history and the history of cyber squatting behavior prove sufficient or not. And the more I think about this process, the more I'm starting to think that these questions can be better written. But at the same time, the point of this question is specifically to look at, did ICANN follow a first strike policy? So if immediately something was found, was an applicant disqualified, or was an applicant not necessarily allowed to continue through the process, or did ICANN rather seek more information in regards to the entity applying, for example, if there was something caught in business diligence, was ICANN seeking more information in regards to a specific incident or the criminal history, for example, if there was one director if there's one director out of 100 that had some form of criminal history, did ICANN immediately say no? It's on paper, it looks like a very an immediate, if you have anything, strike out type of situation. But when ICANN actually carried out the process, did anything come up? Is a good way to look at this, I think. So, were these checks sufficient? Would anyone like to provide any information, or would anyone like to answer this or provide an opinion in regards to the question? Seeing no hands, Jeff provided a bit here. There were lots of ways to get around the cyber squatting background check. UDRPs are generally against entities, not the people who are principals in the entity. Thus, if an individual is a principal in a company that was subject to 10 cyber squatting cases, that individual would not fail the background check if he or she were part of a new GTLD application. Jeff, could you elaborate on that a bit? I'm curious. So if an individual was a part of a company that was subject to 10 cyber squatting cases, that wouldn't fail the entity. But if that individual was, for example, in a directive or executive position within the company, would that fail the new GTLD application? I seem to be asking if question here, but I think for future applicants, if we can expect more applicants in the future, of course, we need to be looking at this question and what it says on paper. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I think that was one of the issues, I don't know if Paul agrees with me or not, but let's say, we could just make up an example. If I am a senior vice president of a company called Company ABC, and ABC has 10 cyber squatting cases against it and it loses, but then I go on in my personal capacity and file a new GTLD, I don't believe the fact that the company I worked for or even was a principal for would be held against me in the new GTLD application, because it's not the company that's listed in the new GTLD application, but me in my personal capacity. So I don't think that would fail the background check. And I think that's how some people got around the whole cyber squatting, background check, etc. Hope that made sense.
Well, Jeff, it does make sense. You jump on a different area that I was looking at. I was looking at does one director and one executive officer really fail the whole applying entity that with 100 executive officers type of question. But no, you've brought up a different and very valuable point of whether or not does the son carry the sins of the father type of question, which can bring us into a very philosophical question. But obviously, does one person that worked at an entity that was found responsible for UDRP really jeopardize the ability of that one individual to found a different company or to apply for a TLD in some different form themselves? So obviously, I think that jumps into a different whose identity they use at the time of applying and whose identity they use at the time of or who are they associated with at the time of when the UDR when there might have been something come up in the criminal history or there might have been the crime in the past type of question. But obviously, that is a way. I'm just trying to think of the best way to formulate that question. I think we should take that one back too and try to formulate something a little bit more specific here. Did anyone have anything else they wanted to provide in regards to this specific area? No? So in the interest of time, let's move on to the next question. So could it be considered that the background screen... Oh, Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, apologies. Yes, given that the question was were they sufficient, and I'm just trying to scroll back to the questions, all of the questions here are about sort of convictions and kind of criminal actions and so on, I think. And I may have missed something, but I think that's the case. And it seems like there maybe is a piece missing, even if it was okay for it to be missing last time around, maybe for a future, there maybe is a piece missing about dealings with ICANN. Have you had a contract with ICANN terminated, or are you going through a process where you're being terminated for failure to pay money to them or for, breaches of serious compliance breaches. It seems like, it seems like there's potentially a missing piece for the future. Now that there are so many more contracted parties with ICANN than there used to be around, how are your dealings with ICANN?
Susan, your question, well, a very valuable question. I think I'd like to expand that question a little bit more. While obviously a very valuable question, I'm just trying to. This specific topic obviously deals with background screening, but when we look at the question of whether or not a registry operator is in jeopardy of losing their contract with ICANN because of missing payments, I'm just wondering which area we could put that into, or how we could ask this question on the whole. Jeff, do you have any ideas on how... I think Susan has a very, very, very valuable question that I think we need to look at. Is basically, any applicant that is looking at any kind of misconduct in regards to registry, at least that's what I understood from that. Susan, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd really like to ask that question.
I'm not sure if I'm correcting you or not, to be clear, I'm not talking about, should my current contract be terminated for breaches? I mean, that's a whole different issue. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about, if I've had a contract, say I've operated 50 registrar businesses and they've all been terminated by ICANN for some form of, compliance issue. Am I a fit and proper person to run a registry?
Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. And I think Susan did a good job. I think you would. It does make another good criteria to ask. So you already have A through O, I guess. You would add a, you'd add a new O. You substitute O, and you would make the current O P, and the new O would say something like has been terminated. Or found in breach of contract by ICANN in the past whatever years you want to do. So it is part of the background check. Have you or your company been been part of an entity that has been previously terminated for breaching a contract, a registry or registrar contract with ICANN. I think that is relevant. So I know that that's looked at in a registrar accreditation, so that any registrar that's de-accredited for malfeasance or not paying or whatever, I know that ICANN would not re-accredit that same organization if it died, you know, the next day or the next year. So I do think it's an additional item for background check.
Thank you, Jeff. I can now see how we can ask that question. So not looking at conduct of the registry, obviously, to follow their responsibilities, but necessarily in terms of breach, whether or not an applicant was found in breach of a contract specifically, and obviously if that did occur, it would prevent an applicant from, it would prevent an applicant from applying for a TLD in the future, but it could be a very, it could be a question that is a factor that's heavily considered. Let's take that back and formulate that a bit more. Susan, thank you for that valuable piece. I'd like to jump onto the next question that I hope does not look at specifically that one question of whether or not you have been found in breach of any of those areas, but could it be considered that the background screening is unnecessary for TLDs where registry protections may not be necessary, such as brand TLDs or those operating with a code of conduct and exemption? So this question was one that I personally had a little bit of personal feeling in. For a lot of entities that apply, especially for those with a more closed type of operation in mind, whether or not these background screenings are specifically relevant is an important question to look at. While a lot of the, you know, for example, brand TLDs likely should be in, of course, proper conduct and should not have any of those specific findings that are listed through A through O, is it really necessary to protect registrants when registrants are no longer applicable for those specific type of TLDs? Yes, no, or your own opinion. Cheryl, go ahead.
Thanks, Cheryl, for the record. And this is one that I would suggest I need to put on my at-large and ALAC knowledge hat. I think if I was to poll that particular cohort within ICANN, the answer would be yes, that it would be a concern. It may not be a block, but it is a concern whereby which, should the answers to those questions, even for brand and non-trading entities, be yes, that should be, in inverted commas, investigated or questioned further, and that a rationale for why sufficient good character is assumed can be given if needs be later. Thanks.
Cheryl, always happy to speak. Sounded like a zoo. Birds going a bit. But Jeff, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, so I think that it's not just registrants that are protected by the background screening. I think it's ICANN as well as an organization that's protected by a number of these. So then you could argue, well, that may not affect the registrant, but if you were the entity entering into a contract or if you were ICANN and having to enter into a contract with this entity, you would not necessarily want to enter into a contract with an organization that's been, let's say, convicted of financial crime or has been disciplined by a governmental authority, you know, you don't necessarily want to take on that liability of entering into an agreement with them. So I think that rather than taking a look at whether it protects the registrants, we should also look at whether it protects ICANN as an organization when you look at these background checks.
Thank you, Jeff. And that's a very valuable point. ICANN is also necessary. Sorry, ICANN needs to consider their own position when obviously contracting with such an entity. Last question, which I hope we would have had more time for. Terry, could I quickly check with you? When my personal calendar says this meeting goes to 6:30, or are we still limited? Sorry. It tells me we go to the half hour on the 21:30 blog. Are we set for only till 21 or 21:30?
Hi, Michael. It's Terry. This call was this meeting was scheduled for 1 hour. We won't cut you off if you happen to run longer. It's just on everybody's schedule, and some may have back-to-back calls. But it is scheduled to end at 2100 UTC.
Does anyone want to spend another hour? Obviously, probably not. I don't want to either, but we'll be back-to-back. But I'm not going to ask this question specifically here. I'd rather take the next 3 minutes to jump on the CC2 topic. But the next question looks at whether or not any of those background checks or any of those specific topics can be, or specific areas that ICANN looks at can be cut, or if any of them, you know, for example, for a brand TLD or a registry with a code of conduct exemption can be could be skipped, for example. But let's look at that in a different time, or hopefully over email. CC2 questions, very quickly. We have 2 minutes. So our objective for CC2 is to come up with questions to ask the community for community comment 2 that will assist us in drawing conclusions. Very important to note, we have only covered 3 subject areas at this point. So question areas and those 3 subject areas should be built upon what we've already discussed, seek further comment, and then looking at our other questions, we need to use the opportunity to get as much detailed feedback as possible for areas that we have not covered up until this point. For everyone's specific, for everyone's view, in green is what we've actually touched on, and then in white is what we have not touched on up until this point. And looking at this just tells me we've still got a very long road to go down. Susan is asking a question that I'm going to turn over to Steve or Jeff. Do we get to do it CC3 at some point for further topics? So I think really quickly, Susan, let me just say that a CC2 is not going to limit us to the specific areas that we've covered up until now. In fact, I think it's rather even more necessary we need to use this opportunity, you know, to ask questions in regards to closed generics or TLD rollout of areas we haven't touched on yet. Jeff, you have your hand up. Jump on the floor.
Yeah. So the plan is not to do a CC3, but we will have a preliminary report, which obviously is open for comment. We are going to try to ask since ahead of time now, help us in CC2 to help us form opinions on even those subjects we haven't covered and rely on people who hopefully go back to their constituencies on the other topics so that they can be prepared when those topics come up for discussion within this work track or any of the work track. In addition, and Steve, I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot here. We do have a calendar of subjects that we intend to cover, at least from now through the end of, now through Hyderabad. No, sorry, we were already there. Sorry. Copenhagen. So Steve can hopefully publish that, and we're going to try to keep that up to date so you know at least a month in advance when a subject is coming up. So, that's our plan at this point in time. Thanks.
Steve, did you want to jump on the mic at all?
Sure. Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Jeff. It's Steve from staff. And yeah, that's not a problem. We'll share with the full group. Like many of our resources these days, it's in a Google document, so we will share that with the full group. And actually, just to jump in on the two question drafting, as Michael noted, we haven't covered all the topics yet. So the questions as we've drafted them now, and which of course will need to be agreed upon by the full working group before being published. So they've been a combination of the topics that we've discussed and the findings and conclusions we may have reached already. So some of the questions are based on that. But also we're pulling in questions that pertain to the issue report, which is a big source of for the questions related to topics that we haven't discussed, of course. So just to give everyone a sense of how we're drafting the CC2 questions, it's based on discussions to date, as well as topics that have already been identified by the discussion group and then expanded upon in the issue report. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. And just to look at the topics again, and the next few slides are really just looking at, it's just a rehash of what these specific areas already are, and what we have been assigned to look at specifically. But it is not obviously necessary to spend an extra 2 or 3 minutes to talk about. With that, I'm going to ask, my only request, of course, is that we will follow this call today with emails in regards to people to start looking at the CC2 questions, start thinking of questions to ask, throw an email into the working track, into the mailing list with your own question. That will really help us out. So I'll send CC2. Susan, good question. CC2. Steve, what is our schedule for CC2 at the current time?
Thanks, Michael. This is Steve from staff. And so the intention is to try to, well, the absolute drop dead is certainly before ICANN 58, but what we're targeting right now is the middle to the late part of February. So the intention would be to try to get the work track agreement on the questions in probably the next week or two to allow for some time to make sure they're discussed at the full working group level as well. So I'd say probably a fair target is probably around the 20th or so or wherever the Monday falls on that in relation to a full working group meeting. So the latter half of February is probably what we're targeting. Thanks.
Thank you. And all right, okay. So that is all the time we have for today. So let's start thinking about those questions, and we'll have emails following and asking those specific questions. So thank you, everyone, for your time. Starting next week, our calls will be shifting to 21 UTC. It came out of a personal request of mine, so I just would like to apologize to everyone in advance. But thank you for your time today, and have a pleasant day, evening, morning, and good night for those of us that are going back to sleep like myself. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining.